This is the second day of this November 2011 7-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim from the book called The Way of Korean Zen by Kusan Sunim. Here, yesterday we read the biography of Kusan Sunim. Today we he takes us into the basics of Zen practice, especially koan practice, the meat and potatoes of sesshin work. The chapter is called Instructions for Meditation. A human being is composed of a body and a mind. A body without a mind is just a corpse. A mind without a body is just pure spirit. Human beings are said to be superior to all other creatures, but how can a human being be considered superior if he knows his body but is ignorant of the nature of his mind? One who knows the body but not the mind is an incomplete person. However, if a human being searches for the mind and awakens to it, he will realize completeness, for at that time he will know both the body and the mind. The marvelous thing about Zen practice is that that in Zazen, it reveals both mind and mind. It reveals both mind with a capital M, that is our true nature, but also at the same time, mind with a small M, that is all of the stuff of the mind. It reveals our patterns of thinking and reacting. We get this on full display in sesshin, where we come to know ourselves, even in knowing with a small k, knowing, that is, knowing our conditioning, our particular personality and character and our dispositions, to use an old Buddhist word, our tendencies. The more sitting we do, the more we see these patterns that distinguish us. Well, they don't all distinguish us. There are many patterns that we have in common, but then in addition, each one of us has particular aspects to our karma that we get to know intimately in sesshin, in any serious zazen. So that's just like along the way. Along the way, we get to see how our mind works. But then, ultimately, to see the very nature of mind, to see into our true nature. He goes on, "The purpose of practicing Zen meditation is to awaken to the mind. Such practice does not involve just sitting quietly and trying to calm and pacify the mind. Nor does it entail contemplating the breath. Instead, it involves direct inquiry into a koan. An example of a koan would be a question such as, 'What is this?' or 'What is this mind?' What you are searching for can be called by many different names: mind, spirit, soul, true nature, and so forth. But such designations are merely labels. You should put aside all of these names and reflect on the fact that the true master of the body is more than just the label mind. The master of the body is not the Buddha, for it is not yet awakened. Nor is it anything material, because it cannot be physically given away or received. Nor is it simply empty space, for empty space cannot pose questions or have knowledge of good and evil. This word master, I think, works better in a Confucian culture than in our own. Confucian culture, everything is ordered hierarchically, and this is a question that came to Japanese Zen master Basui. Who is the master? It's no different from the question, what is my original self? What was this original self before my parents gave birth to me? What is Mu? Hence, there is a master who rules this body who is neither the label mind, the Buddha, a material thing, nor empty space. Having negated these four possibilities, a question will arise as to what this master really is. If you continue inquiring in this way, the questioning will become more intense. Finally, when the mass of questioning enlarges to a critical point, it will suddenly burst. The entire universe will be shattered, and only your original nature will appear before you. In this way, you will awaken. The entire universe will be shattered, of course, does not mean literally, but rather it really means that you see through the world of phenomena. You see through the universe, yourself, all beings, all things. He continues, it is most important to continuously investigate the koan with unswerving determination. At the beginning, you might feel as though you are trying to lift a heavy bucket full of water with a weak arm. Even so, you should never relax your effort. In other words, we can feel so ineffectual in our ability to, in our efforts to concentrate, and feel as though we're up against something that is beyond us, that we don't have the ability to really carry this out. Even so, you should never relax your effort. Instead, no matter what you are doing, be solely concerned with nothing but the koan. If a clock were unreliable and kept stopping, any sensible person would either have it repaired or get rid of it. Similarly, when practicing Zazen, you must exert continuous effort and not allow yourself to be lazy. Now, I've learned over the years that when people hear this kind of encouragement to exert continuous effort, some people will feel like a failure because they mistake continuous effort with continuous success. Two very different things. We're never going to be thoroughly absorbed in our practice at all times, indefinitely. There are going to be periods where we lose it, and early in our practice, early in sesshin, or for years, usually in our practice outside sesshin, we lose it a lot. That has nothing to do with continuous effort. We can still make the effort. We can still make the effort continuous. It's not going to be any kind of continuous success, but just the effort. Effort means, of course, noticing. After noticing when we've lost it, when the mind has wandered, to bring it back. There's the effort, bringing it back. Let me repeat. That's the effort, bringing the mind back to the practice. It's not some kind of superhuman perfection, perfect concentration. So what else would one do? Well, we all know. Noticing, when we notice the mind has wandered, then we start commenting on that in our mind. Ah, damn it. He lost it again. How many times? What's wrong? Can't you concentrate? You've got to have the worst concentration of anyone in the Zendo. Look at everyone else, sitting so straight and perfect. What a loser you are. This, by the way, this little dialogue comes from experience, personal experience. No, none of that garbage helps at all. It just creates a hindrance. It's much simpler. When you notice the mind has wandered, move. 5 seconds later, you notice it's wandered again, move. Not, oh, there you go again. 2 seconds later, it's wandered again. What do you do? Move. Move. Breath. What is it? We keep getting sidetracked by this commentary involving the self. My practice. There it is, intruding again. My practice is such and such. No need for that. The worst is to consciously, when you even catching yourself with the mind having wandered, to just consciously decide, well, I want to think about something else instead. That's where there's a lapse of effort. That's where the effort is broken. Just indulging in fantasies or thoughts about things, knowingly doing it. Much of the time when the mind wanders, we're not aware of it until we are. But to consciously ruminate about things instead of going back to the practice, to consciously indulge in daydreams, this is bound to keep us blocked. He goes on. In Zen meditation, the key factor is to maintain a constant sense of questioning. Well, he's really saying in koan meditation, the key factor is to maintain a constant sense of questioning. This is what distinguishes koan practice from breath practice. Koan practice, at its best, enlists this mind of questioning that is the distinctive to our species. We can be reasonably sure that non-human creatures, insects, animals, do not have existential questions of what is the nature of reality, what is death, where do I come from, where am I going. this is the genius of the koan, is that it harnesses this native, this basic human wondering about reality, and harnesses it and focuses it on this one word, this one koan. And it's when it's focused like that, instead of diffuse, the questioning I'm referring to, once we bring it into a focus, then it can start a fire. It's like a magnifying glass. The koan serves as a magnifying glass to focus that questioning. In breath practice, there is no questioning as such. It's a concentration practice. It's a practice of becoming one with. And a koan practice can also be that. And I've also learned over the years that for some people, it doesn't work for them to question. They just feel frustrated. That feels artificial. They can't transfer the underlying questioning about reality. They can't transfer it to the koan. This is not unusual. I remember the same thing for years. My practice was, and my practice of mu was just the pure concentration on the word mu. But then what I found was at a certain point of absorption, just in the word mu, then this mu became perplexing. And that's where the questioning originates. So I often say to people who say that they can't seem to generate any questioning, to just, all right, then just don't try to force yourself to do something that feels artificial, but just become completely one with the koan. Here, Kusan Sunim is taking a harder stand about the questioning. The key factor is to maintain a constant sense of questioning. So having taken hold of the koan, what is this, try to always sustain the questioning. What is seeing? What is hearing? What is moving these hands and feet? And so on. In addition, you should try to make this questioning smooth and regular. But this does not mean that you should just mechanically repeat the question as though it were a mantra. It is useless to just say to yourself day and night, what is this, what is this, what is this, what is this, what is this. The key is to sustain the sense of questioning, not the repetition of the words. Once this inquiry gets underway, there will be no room for boredom. If the mind remains quiet, the koan will not be forgotten, and the sense of questioning will continue unbroken. In this way, awakening will be easy. So when we're just repeating the koan mechanically, which always means that our attention is split. We can sort of sustain the mechanics of asking the question, but it's not with our whole mind. Our mind is fragmented. So when we are doing it merely mechanically, then that invites boredom. Any time that we're doing anything without our full attention, then we are more vulnerable to becoming bored. And conversely, when we are completely absorbed in anything, then there is no room for boredom. Boredom can't get any purchase in the mind. So it's a nice little biofeedback mechanism. When you notice you're bored, it means you have to step it up, get more concentrated on the practice. And then the boredom will be dispelled. And this isn't just sitting. This isn't anything in our daily life. If we feel bored, it means we're not really paying full attention. Even a boring person, and there are some out there, even a boring person who's just droning on and on, can we find a way to get more, to listen better, and not listen just to the boring words, but listen to what is behind the words, what's going on with that person really, when they're so separated from what they're saying. Boredom is always principally the responsibility of the listener, of the one who's feeling bored. Can't ever blame others or circumstances for our boredom. We know this from Sesshin. We're facing a blank wall, for God's sake. And we know that we can get to the point where it's anything but boring. This goes to prove that it's all in the mind. It's not the circumstances. It's not the conditions. We've got to take responsibility for how we're using or misusing the mind. He goes on, while meditating, both wisdom and concentration need to be cultivated in unison. Well, this is, I don't think this is helpful for people to be thinking, to be thinking about two things and whether or not you're balanced in your wisdom and concentration. He goes on, when inquiring single-pointedly into the koan, what is this? The vividness of the koan becomes wisdom, and the cessation of distracted thoughts becomes concentration. So there are these two elements, and that's what we can draw from this, is that we can be pretty concentrated on the koan or the breath, but without any real vividness to it. It's kind of a dull state of rest. But we want to have it bright. We want to have it sharp and clear. This is what he means by wisdom. Because we can be sharp and clear, but without the mind at rest. And we can have the mind at rest without it being sharp and clear. Meditation can be compared to a battle between wandering thoughts and dullness of mind on the one side and the koan on the other. The stronger the koan becomes, the weaker will become wandering thoughts and dullness. You are not the first, and you will not be the last to tread this path. So do not become discouraged if you find the practice difficult at times. all the previous patriarchs of old, as well as the contemporary masters, have experienced hardships along this way. Moreover, it is not always the most virtuous or intelligent person who makes the swiftest progress. Sometimes the opposite is true. There are many cases of troublesome and ill-behaved people who, upon turning their attention inward to the practice of meditation, have quickly experienced a breakthrough. So do not feel defeated even before you have really begun. This is a major obstruction that too many people carry with them, is they have this sense of themselves, have a sense of their character or their strengths and weaknesses, and on balance they find that they have too many obstructions in the mind, and so therefore they're not up to the task. But as Kusan Sunim says here, you don't know. You don't have to be at all pure of mind, pure of character, or anything special to see into the koan, to break through. But you do have to have an empty mind in order to break through it. In other words, you can have a lot of sharp corners and rough edges to your personality, and still you can reach a state of mental purity long enough to have the mind open. And then you still have all those sharp corners and rough edges to smooth out in the years that follow a breakthrough. But it can be done. So don't let yourself be thinking about your deficiencies and then sort of resign yourself to not going beyond them. The key thing is not to be thinking about oneself. If you're not thinking about yourself, then this will be no obstruction. There no such obstruction can occur. There's a saying in Zen, strong ego, strong spirit. Sometimes people with the strongest sense of self have the strongest spirit. And so it compensates. You can rouse the mind with that kind of spirit. You can rouse the mind and go very far. And then again, you still be left to clean up the defilements. An ancient master once said that with the passing of the days, you will see your thoughts becoming identical with the koan, and the koan becoming identical with your thoughts. This is quite true. In the final analysis, the practice of Zen can be said to be both the easiest as well as the most difficult thing to do. However, do not thereby deceive yourself into thinking that it will be either very simple or extremely hard. It's the easiest because in the case of a koan like Mu, let's say, all you have to do, it's not complicated, you just have to keep returning the mind to the word Mu. You don't have to figure anything out. This is very hard for some people to learn. They keep thinking, because of their conditioning, their habit, that a koan is something to be figured out. It can't be figured out. By figured out, I'm talking about figured out with the intellect, with the mind of reasoning and analysis and discrimination. No, that stuff won't help at all with the koan. It's much simpler than that, than figuring anything out. It's not like a Sudoku puzzle or a, any kind of... It's not a riddle. It's not a puzzle. It's just your own nature. This is what every koan has in common. It's all just an expression in words for our true nature. We don't need to figure out our true nature. We just need to be it. Be mu. Be this question, what is this? Be it. Don't figure it out. There is no one who can undertake this task for you. The student's hunger can never be satisfied by his teacher's eating a meal for him. It's like competing in a marathon. The winner will only be the person who is either the fittest or the most determined. It is solely up to the individual to win the race. Likewise, to achieve the aim of your practice, do not be distracted by things that are not related to this task. For the time being, just let everything else remain as it is and put it out of your mind. Only when you are awakened will you be able to truly benefit others. Yeah, these last two sentences are worth commenting on. For the time being, just let everything else remain as it is. Remain as it is. Leave the thoughts. Let the thoughts be thoughts. We don't need to do anything with the thoughts. It's not our job. Let them be. And put it out of your mind, which just means put your mind fully on the practice. Strictly speaking, we're not trying to get rid of... I'm not trying to put the thoughts out of our mind. But putting still means doing something with them. There's nothing we need to do with the thoughts. Let them be. Just keep returning to the practice. And then the last sentence, only when you are awakened will you be able to truly benefit others. Only when we have seen through the nature of the mind and seen through this notion of self and other, only then can we most fully and purely help others. In other words, it is only when we have seen the illusion of the ego, of the self, that we are free to serve, to help others fully. And even after a first breakthrough, even after gotten an inkling of this illusory nature of the self, still there is more purification that has to happen. It's not like it goes, it's like a black and white, that one minute where our efforts to help others are colored by our own neurotic needs and confusion. And then the next minute, we're in the clear and we're just vessels of compassion. It's not that way. But through ongoing practice and ongoing deeper awakening experiences, then we become more and more empty, meaning more and more able as vessels to give. And that's what the practice is all about. It's not just trying to solve some of our personal problems and become less anxious and stressful. Really, in the Mahayana, it's all about our ability to give and to serve others, to help suffering beings. This is why we recite the four vows over and over again. All beings without number I vow to liberate. When people discuss the practice of meditation, they often refer to a person having either a superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task. Yeah, this is more a thing that you run across in the Chinese and Korean texts. I don't think they certainly don't help to, if you're thinking about yourself, if you're trying to put yourself in one of these categories as having a superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task, I think it's not at all useful to do that. Well, of course it's not, because you're still thinking about yourself. The whole problem is when we're thinking about ourselves, and to categorize yourself in one of these three slots is to be thinking about yourself. It's true that some of us have heavier karma as a result of how we have lived in the past. But then, as he says, these capacities are not inborn qualities. None of us is stuck with our afflictions. That's the whole point of practice, is wherever we're starting, whatever our baggage is, we can change it. Of course. He goes on, for once a strong motivation has been generated, then a person is immediately endowed with a superior capacity. Notice that. It's in the motivation. Once a strong motivation has been generated, then right away you're there. You're ready to break through. It's not a matter of one's character. It's one's ardor. He continues, nevertheless, there are different levels of motivation. Some people may leave the care of their parents and relatives and become monks or nuns with the sincere motivation to realize Buddhahood. But after practicing for a while, they discover that the aim of meditation is not achieved as easily as cooling hot cereal by pouring cold water on it. I love that. I always remember that. Okay, so this work is not as easy, no, as cooling hot cereal by pouring cold water on it. Such persons may become disheartened when their practice does not proceed as smoothly as they had expected. However, a person of superior capacity is able to completely cut off the mind of discrimination as soon as he is told to do so. For those who are unable to do this, much hardship, effort, and total determination are needed before they can achieve this state. Roshi Kaplow told me that he attended 56 7-day sessions before he got through Mu. And for a lot of those, the earlier ones, he hated Sesshin. It just goes to show what tremendous need there was that he kept going back to Sesshin, hating it that much. And that's what always wins in the end. That's what captures the day, is that the need. It all comes down to the need. How much do you need to know who you are? How much do you need to know what Mu is, what this is? That can overcome all obstacles, that need. It's not to be confused with wanting. Of course, everyone wants to come to enlightenment. Who wouldn't? But if there is the need, then things open. Most people who meditate on a koan intend at the outset to keep a firm hold on it. But usually, after a very short while, the koan disappears and they just lose themselves in thoughts. If someone persists in such a way, when will he ever awaken? Others, after a few initial attempts to hold on to the koan, find that it does not appear to them spontaneously. So they just sit still without doing anything at all. Such people then ask me, "What do you claim there to be? Surely there is just nothing." The problem here is that although they tried to hold on to the koan, they found nothing that they could take firm hold of. Thus they conclude that there is nothing at all. But such conclusions are only reached intellectually. Indeed, as long as you continue just to scheme and conceptualize with the intellect, you will find nothing to take firm hold of. But to them proclaim that in reality there is just nothing is mere foolishness. You know, I have rarely heard this thing trotted out by students in Doksan, having anyone say, "Well, after all, there's nothing." It seems to be more of a problem in China and Korea and Japan maybe than among Westerners. But what he says is certainly true. It's just a little intellectual game when you arrive at the conclusion that there's nothing. That's not really seeing the formlessness of form, seeing the no-thingness of things. It's just toying with thoughts of nothingness. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.